From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Albert Brooks. He directed, co-wrote, and stars in the new film Mother, about a divorced middle-aged man who thinks his emotional problems were caused by his relationship with his mother. So he moves back in with her to find out what went wrong. We'll talk with Brooks about his new movie, his own mother, his father, who was also in the comedy business, his first film role in Taxi Driver, and more. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new box set, Miles Davis and Gil Evans, The Complete Columbia Studio Recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The television industry today unveiled its system for rating TV programs. The head of the Motion Picture Association, Jack Valenti, who led the industry effort, says the plan will meet the concerns of critics.
We are organizing a monitoring oversight board whose mandate it is to view retrospectively programs in the marketplace and to take under consideration those that might have come under criticism for the misapplication of guidelines. Their overall objective is to try to bring to the marketplace as much uniformity and consistency as is humanly possible.
But opponents say the plan won't give parents enough information about programs. They say it's too vague and doesn't distinguish between violence, foul language, and sexual content. There is no break in sight in the hostage standoff in Lima, Peru. Leftist rebels have been holding nearly 500 people since Tuesday night. They continue to demand the release of their jailed comrades. Paul Miller reports from Lima.
Negotiations began again this morning with a team of foreign ambassadors acting as a link between the rebels and the Peruvian government. The International Red Cross reports that conditions in the residence are tranquil. The hostage takers, armed with grenades and automatic weapons, have allowed food, water, and medical supplies into the house. They've also let the hostages send messages to their families. Police, ambulances, and hundreds of journalists are waiting on the streets outside. The rebels are demanding the release of their leaders and hundreds of others currently held in Peruvian prisons. Former UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar, now an opposition politician, has urged the government not to give in to the demands. For National Public Radio, I'm John Miller in Lima.
Hong Kong's leader-designate today returned from meetings with top leaders in Beijing, saying he feels more confident that Hong Kong will be able to maintain its own way of life after it reverts to Chinese control next year. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Hong Kong.
Tung Chee Hwa's trip to Beijing this week was a chance for him to be formally anointed as Hong Kong's future leader. The Hong Kong shipping magnate said today that he's reassured by Chinese President Jiang Zemin's pledge to honor Hong Kong's autonomy. While Beijing promised to support Tung's rule, Tung said he can't imagine any problems that would prompt him to ask for Beijing's direct intervention. What Tung has asked for is cooperation from the current Hong Kong government, especially in easing the transition from the current elected Legislative Council to the provisional legislature that will be selected by a Beijing-picked committee this weekend. Hong Kong Governor Chris Patten has said he's happy to cooperate with Tung, but as long as he's in charge, the Hong Kong government will have nothing to do with a rollback of democracy. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Hong Kong.
Stock prices are generally higher at this hour. The Dow is up 52 points at 6398.67. You're listening to news from National Public Radio. A new report today says the North American Free Trade Agreement's impact on American jobs has been near zero. A University of California report says the impact of the 1994 agreement loosening trade restrictions between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. It says at the same time it created 49,000 jobs from exports to Mexico. Meanwhile, imports from Mexico have taken away more than 38,000 jobs. The study also finds less than half of the 11,000 people who've lost their jobs due to NAFTA have been deemed eligible for a government program of retraining and special unemployment benefits. A federal district judge has ruled that government restrictions on the export of computer encryption programs are unconstitutional. NPR's John McChesney reports.
U.S. District Judge Marilyn Hall Patel ruled in San Francisco that current restrictions on the export of encryption software are an interference with freedom of speech. Encryption software encodes internet communication so they can't be understood by anyone other than the intended recipient. Judge Patel ruled in favor of an Illinois mathematics professor who developed an encryption program called Snuffle, which could not be exported under current regulations. U.S. software companies have complained bitterly that those regulations are costing them millions of dollars while foreign competitors continue to sell strong encryption programs. Jim Bidsos, the chief of RSA Data Security, the largest domestic encryption software maker, says he's encouraged by the ruling, but adds that it's not binding outside of Northern California.
I'm sure the government will probably appeal, and I, for one, am not going to be exporting any source code tomorrow.
In San Francisco, I'm John McChesney, reporting.
Sesame Street's Elmo has canceled an appearance on the Live with Regis and Kathy Lee show. The folks at the Children's Television Network say Elmo would be uncomfortable on the talk show after Philbin said he hated him. Philbin says his comment had to do with the hysteria being generated by the Tickle Me Elmo doll. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our film critic John Powers calls Albert Brooks the funniest man in America, our leading satirist of middle-class self-indulgence. Brooks has written, directed, and starred in the films Real Life, Modern Romance, Lost in America, and Defending Your Life. He started his career as a stand-up comic. In addition to making his own movies, he co-starred as an insecure journalist in broadcast news and as a campaign worker and taxi driver. In his new movie, Mother, which he directed and co-wrote, Brooks plays a middle-aged man in the early stages of a divorce. He knows he's an emotional mess, and he blames his insecurities on his hypercritical mother, played by Debbie Reynolds. In an attempt to understand what went wrong in his relationship with his mother, he moves back in with her. As soon as he walks in the door, he knows he's in trouble.
Want something to eat?
No.
I made some salad, and I have some meatloaf.
I don't eat meat.
Oh, that's right. This Jeff who loves it.
I'll have some salad.
Well, don't have salad just for my sake.
No, I'll have it.
Are you sure you want salad?
Yes, I want salad.
Not just for my sake.
Mother, I don't get into this food stuff now, please. Just give me a little salad.
Oh, I know what I could do. I could scrape the top off the meatloaf.
What would that do?
Well, it wouldn't be as much meat then.
But it's still meat. What difference does it make how much you have?
You really don't like meat, huh?
No, Mother, I don't like eating cows.
Oh, honey, everything comes from a cow. Everything.
What inspired the idea of having the character that you play move back in with his mother?
Well, one of the most fun things about a movie is that you can do things that you probably would never do. And, you know, the characters that I've played in my motion pictures are very earnest and try to explore to the nth degree what they, you know, these, you know, in Lost in America, actually selling your house and buying a motor home, and real life actually filming a family and burning their house down. And so this is what I think sort of is, you know, part of what these characters are about. So the idea that in order to really figure out your mother, you've got to go back and recreate the situation where you grew up, and, you know, and of course my character calls it the experiment, and actually play it out much better than just phoning her up and saying, who are you?
The classic Jewish mother in a lot of American fiction and movies is the critical, domineering, overprotective mother. The mother in your movie is critical, but she doesn't care quite enough about the son. So she's not domineering and overprotective. The son almost wishes that she was.
Right. Nor do I think this is a Jewish mother, but because the Jewish mother is too, as you know, such a cliche of exactly what you say. And I don't, I wasn't out to make it a particular religion. I think that, you know, there are two kinds of mothers on the planet, no matter what religion or who they are, and that's either the mothers that think everything their children do are perfect, or the other kind. And this is about the other kind. They can be Catholics, Protestants, Jews, or atheists. It's just the idea that, you know, they're critical. However, the real mothers. The mothers that I have met, once the children leave, they don't want them back. Who would want them back? Did you ever see a bird when the other birds leave the nest? They tear down the nest and find a tree and don't tell the other birds where that tree is. So it's, you know, the idea that they want children back is silly to me. And that's the cliche part. Being critical isn't.
So is your mother really critical?
Well, she's, you know, loving, but she's, it's not, and I wouldn't even call it critical. My mother has always sort of been puzzled why I'm who I am. And I think one of the reasons is that if my mother and I, if there was one thing we didn't share, it probably was she didn't get my sense of humor. You know, sense of humor is a very personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can love a child and still have no idea why other people are laughing at them. So I think that my mother was always sort of, I mean, I know from doing, I must have done 50 Tonight shows when, you know, Carson was hosting, and the audience would laugh their head off, and my mother and I would always have the same conversation after every show, which was basically I would say, "Did you see it?" And she would say, "Oh, honey, it was wonderful. What did Johnny think?" And I would say, "Well, he liked it, but did you like it?" "No, of course, honey, but Johnny liked it." You know, so that was going to be my autobiography title, "What Did Johnny Think?"
Now, there's some very funny things about food in the new movie. You know, your character mm-hmm. comes back to the mother's house, and she saves a lot of food in the freezer, where it's guaranteed to taste really bad after a while.
Yes.
And she buys all those horrible store brands in the movie. It's Sweet Tooth Sherbert.
Yes, I made that up.
Oh, is it perfect, though?
Yes.
So was this a problem at your home, too, that your mother would buy all the cheap brands?
That part is my mother could afford anything, but she just didn't believe that there was, you know, like Debbie says in the movie, "Honey, there's no difference. The man in the store told me it's just the label." I think that my mother probably has said that to me. I really think that somewhere in the back of her mind, she felt that all food came from the same vat in Chicago and they just, you know, put on a different label somewhere.
Did you ever go ahead.
I'm saying, I mean, we had brands of food. They looked like the real thing. I mean, like the cookies, you know, they were black with white in the middle, but it was like, you know, Sorios. It was one letter off. And, you know, there's a thing that I love in this movie, this sherbet that's been in the freezer for about 16 years and you can't even see it anymore. And I say to, you know, my mother in the movie, I say, "Look at this crap that sits on the top," and she has named it. She says, "Oh no, honey, you look under the protective ice."
Yeah, I love the protective ice. Yeah.
I said, "You've named this stuff? I can't believe it." But my mother still, to this day, my mother has this Neapolitan ice cream. There aren't three colors anymore. It's just one color it's blended into. I don't know what that color is even, but the chocolate and vanilla and strawberry have long ago stopped being divided. They just are like a light yellow.
Albert Brooks is my guest, and his new movie comedy is called Mother. The roles that you write for yourself are often characters that are very self-absorbed and very selfish in their own way and don't see their own flaws.
That's a new twist. But I'm just trying to think if I agree with that. I don't know if that's necessarily true about being selfish. I think they're
well, modern romance, it's true.
Oh, modern romance. Well, modern romance wasn't so much selfish. I mean, there's a guy trapped in a relationship that, you know, he shouldn't be in, and he's desperately trying to hang on for dear life. I mean, it's not like, you know, if he were in control, if he actually was with somebody that, you know, he was supposed to be with, I don't think he would be selfish. He's only selfish because she's, you know, she's has no, really shouldn't be with him, and I think he senses that
right.
And gets panicked, you know.
I guess what I'm trying to ask is, do you want to play characters that are completely lovable, or that, you know, you love them, you identify with them, but then you also stand back a little bit and say, but wait a minute, he's going too far with this, or he's too self-absorbed?
Well, are you asking me, do I want to?
Yeah. When you're creating the character.
I'll tell you, you know, I think it's very dangerous if you start to write characters where you say, I want to be loved. I think the thing that you do is you tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And when you create a story, the character needs to be faithful to that story. I mean, let's take modern romance. Here was an obsessive relationship. A guy's in a wrong relationship and drives this woman crazy. There'd be no way to tell that story and make that character lovable. I mean, you couldn't, then you just shouldn't make that movie. So right. I sort of like, you know, figure out what story I want to tell, and then the characters need to, you know, be appropriate to the story.
In some of your early work as a comic, back when you were doing stand-up, and, mm-hmm. and in some of your really early movie work, you made fun of a certain showbiz kind of comedy.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you must have grown up with that. Your father was a comic.
Yeah. Well, my father died when I was 11, but I still, you know, remember that it was okay to, you know, be funny. And I watched somebody do it for a living, even though he pretty much was out of it by the time I was born. I used to listen. He was a radio comedian. He went under the name of Parkia Karkas. And he was a Greek dialect comedian. And that's the character he played. And even though he was off the air when I was born, we used to have these huge, you know, those big 16-inch records of all the radio shows, and I would listen to it, and I sort of was able to see into show business early, you know. Somehow I got it, that it might not be exactly what you think it is.
How did your father, who I assume was Jewish, his name was Einstein, how did he get to play a Greek dialect comic?
Well, he played, you know, during the 40s when he was on the air. I think being an immigrant coming to America was a very popular thing. And I don't know how exactly or where. I know he was born in Boston, and he worked in the advertising business, and I think he just did this character for fun. And then Eddie Cantor heard him once at a dinner, and actually I think thought he was really Greek, and said, talk to him slowly like he wouldn't understand him, would you like to come to New York and be on my show? And my father said, you can talk faster, I'm born in America. And I don't know why he came up with that, but I think the idea of the poor immigrant who comes to America was something that, you know, obviously he liked.
When you started doing comedy, your comedy was it came out of who you were as a real person.
Yeah.
And a lot of your monologues were pretty autobiographical.
Right. I never told jokes. I don't think I've ever told a joke in my life.
Right. So this more autobiographical approach was really different from where your father was coming from, where he didn't even play his own ethnic group, let alone talk about his life.
Absolutely. And that's exactly right. Yeah.
Did you feel like you had any models for what you wanted to do, a more autobiographical approach?
No, I'll tell you, when I was very young, I remember watching Jack Benny and thinking that this man figured it all out. Jack Benny really never told jokes. I mean, look what he did. He would stare and people would laugh, and his persona was so clear. It was so, the audience understood it so well that he really, you know, he was amazing. He was the world's great minimalist.
Is that what you were trying for, to do very little and have it be very effective?
Or just sort of a, you know, those old guys used to play themselves. This is not a new thing, Jerry mm-hmm. Seinfeld and mm-hmm. stuff. This is one of the original things that radio and television did. George mm-hmm. Burns and Jack Benny and Fred Allen. It was their lives we were laughing at. So I think it was, you know, it just showed you that you didn't have to stand up there and say, my wife is fat. There were other things to do. But actually, the kind of comedy I did, I really didn't see before I did it. So I didn't have a role model in that somebody was making fun of I sort of was making fun of the institutions that were still going on. When I first started, you know, I tried out everything I ever did on national television. There weren't any clubs to even go to if I wanted to. So it was interesting because I sort of would think up things in my house and drive down to NBC and do them on the Dean Martin show. And at that point, if if you were funny, all people would say to you is, when are you going to Vegas? And, you know, that's all they associated mm-hmm. it with. And I tried to sort of change that, just at least for myself. I mean, not, you know, in any great sense that I'm going to change the world, but I just sort of, I remember I always would say, when people would say, are you funny? Yes, but I'm, you know, but it's not, but I'm trying to be real too. I mean, I was trying to give dignity to this idea of doing stand-up because it had none. Everyone who ever, you know, heard you that you did comedy just thought that you were just sitting there with a big cigar and opening for Frank Sinatra.
My guest is Albert Brooks. His new movie, Mother, opens Christmas Day. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor, director, and screenwriter Albert Brooks. His new movie is called Mother. Brooks started his career as a stand-up comic. Early in his career, he did stand-up on the TV variety shows like Dean Martin and Merv Griffin. His contemporaries thought he was funny, but on the variety shows, he played to a predominantly older audience that often didn't know what to make of him. Here's an example.
Well, the first thing I ever did was a ventriloquist act called Danny and Dave, which was basically the world's worst ventriloquist. He was introduced as, you know, a real ventriloquist, and his mouth moved more than the dummy, and the dummy used to drink water while he would sing, and, you know, I would do all of those ventriloquist tricks where I would try to smoke a cigarette, and, you know, I just threw the dummy on the floor to get him out of my hand so I could smoke. And, you know, many people laughed, and a couple of people in the very beginning said, that's the worst ventriloquist I've ever seen. So, and this happened in my first movie. When I did Real Life, I played a character called Albert Brooks. And, you know, here was a man named Albert Brooks who set up this whole thing as a realistic experiment of filming a family and trying to make it a sociological experiment. And I would say half the reviews I got in America were real. I still remember, you know, I remember, I'm not sure if it was Rex Reed or somebody who said, why in God's name would a studio give this man money to do such an important experiment? And, you know, I was stunned. I always thought everybody got, you know, figured everything out, but they didn't. And so it just took years to sort of, you know, maybe make a few people realize that this was thought of and it wasn't just a bad act.
Well, it's kind of like the whole world was on your mother's wavelength and not quite getting the jokes.
Yes, not the whole world, but a lot of people. And you're exactly right, yeah.
So you went from one scene to another. You went from the TV variety shows, which had an older audience, and then you went to opening for rock acts.
That's right.
Neil Diamond and Richie Havens. So it's one extreme to another.
Exactly. I did. You know, I sort of had a whole reverse thing because, like, everybody else does clubs and then gets on television. I did about 5 years of television before I ever performed in front of a live concert audience. I actually remember the first time I ever performed was in Mississippi with Neil Diamond, and I had just done in the previous year, when Merv Griffin was on CBS, I had done like 15 of his shows. And I remember trying to put together bits of a Merv Griffin show to do as a half hour in front of a live audience. I didn't even have the transitions in my mind yet of talking to a group of people because I was so used to these bits. And it was very, sometimes it was fun, but opening for rock acts in the early 70s, I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
Why not?
Well, it was way before comedy was in or even, you know, popular in any regard. You know, comedy sort of didn't start to get this popularity until, I guess, were the 80s. And let's face it, these people took a lot of drugs and went to see, you know, they wanted to hear the loudest music they could hear. And I think there's an old Chinese adage that says 16 sleeping pills does not make for a good comedy audience. You know, they took a lot of these downers and would sit there and they were waiting for, you know, Sly and the Family Stone and the disc jockey had to come out and tell him I was there.
Right, and you were going to come on and talk about things that made you neurotic and insecure.
Right there.
Yeah,
stop. It doesn't matter. It's called talk about. It's not,
right.
The human voice they were waiting to hear. They wanted to hear these amplifiers turned up to a billion decibels. They wanted to be hurt, you know? So I had some very rough experiences trying to get people to listen. I remember once I did open for Sly, and it was in Tacoma, Washington. And the show was at 8 o'clock, and my phone rang at 7:30 in the hotel, and actually a motel, a little teeny room there. And it was Sly, you know, Sly and the Family Stone. It was his manager, and at that time it wasn't a secret. Sly was, you know, experimenting with Columbia's most famous product, and I don't mean the studio. And and so the guy said to me, he said, let me ask you something, Albert. How long do you do? I said, well, you know, normally a half hour, but I'm a little worried about this audience, maybe 20 minutes. He said, you know, and now we're in Tacoma. He said, what's the longest you can do? I said, well, I don't know. Why? Well, Sly called, and he's in Cincinnati. he had missed the plane. I said, what? He's in Cincinnati? I said, well, you know, what are you talking about? I got to do 3.5 hours? Well, actually, it would be longer because he can't get a plane until 7. I said, look, you got the wrong guy here. I don't know if I should even go on. So I actually did go on, and I remember somebody threw a beer can and cut my leg, and I got angry at the audience. I started to yell at them and said, he's not even here, and I'm going to go on Johnny Carson and tell them that you're horrible, and as if they would all stop and go, ooh. Anyway, I just got out of town quickly. I ran off the stage. It was not fun.
You see, you could have said you had 2 hours left and then taken questions from the audience for the
oh,
next
yeah,
2 hours.
Questions, right, like, how do you want to be killed, fire or knife? That would have been the question. No, it was bad. And I'll tell you what I did do. I still remember. I went back because all their equipment was there. And I started to just play a bass note like the beginning of a Supreme song. Boom, 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 boom. And they all quieted down. And I couldn't play. And so, you know, I was just quiet. They just were ready. And I tried to say very patiently, he's not even here. But, you know, they didn't care. They weren't in the mood to be polite. And I think drugs and comedy don't go well.
Yeah. Albert Brooks, his new movie Mother opens Christmas Day. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Ghosts of Mississippi, a Rob Reiner film, at select theaters tomorrow. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hey, George, I might leave out number letter F, you know? In fact, I might leave out all this part.
Yeah.
Coming up, a review of the complete Columbia studio recordings of Miles Davis and Gil Evans, including alternate takes and snippets of studio conversations. And more with Albert Brooks. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor, director, and screenwriter Albert Brooks. His new movie is called Mother. When we left off, we were talking about his early career as a stand-up comic. Since we were talking about some of your early comedy, I thought we'd play something from your first comedy album, which has been reissued on Rhino Records.
Yeah. And I think what are you going to play?
Well, I think my favorite sketch on here is rewriting the national anthem.
Oh.
And the premise of this is that nobody goes around singing the national anthem anymore, so we should hold open auditions and find a new national anthem.
Yes.
What inspired the sketch?
Well, the national anthem is, you know, one of the silliest songs ever written. I don't think there's an American alive who knows the words, and I just sort of figured that it would, like the introduction says on the record, it would be a funny idea if people had to come to Washington and sit down at a piano and try to sell the country on a new one. So I played various people coming up with songs, and I sort of, you know, had a guy there who was supposed to moderate the whole thing and tell him yes or no.
Why don't we hear it?
Okay.
Dan Allen, Denver, Colorado. Miles from coast to coast. Every citizen has reason to boast. Thank you. Thank you.
Can the lights be changed at all? All right, it's not important. Before I sing my song, I should tell you a bit about myself. My name is Mr. Robert Bob Harmon. And I currently live and work in the very exciting city of Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm an entertainer. And you know, Vegas is a great place, an exciting place, but originally I'm from a much quieter place, a place up north, out west, a place I call Portland. What a great place it is. In one 30-square-mile radius, there's more to do than almost anywhere in the world. There's hunting and fishing and boating and camping. Get on with it! I am. It's how I get into it in the actor. It's got beautiful waterfalls and gorgeous trees, but you know, it's part of a bigger place. It's part of a country. Can you guess which country it is? No, it's not Denmark or Poland or Sweden or Rome. Get on with it! It's a lovely place I call home, I'm proud to say. I've got a country. Got a country. I spell it A-M-E-R-I-C-A. Get off this stage! Thank you.
That's Albert Brooks from his first comedy record, Comedy Minus One, which has been reissued on Rhino Records. Now, hearing all those really inspired anthem satires that you came up with, made me think that you must actually know something about music. That's you, yes, at the piano, isn't it?
Yes, and yes, I play piano, and I think that music and first of all, music and comedy are very, very similar because, you know, there's that word timing. And I think that in essence, comedy is a form of music. When you're making people laugh, there are stopping and starting and louder and softer and all the things that music have. I know that when I'm working on a motion picture, one of the earliest things I do is I sort of think of what kind of music should be in this particular motion picture. It helps me write. So I've always been musical. I taught myself to play the piano when I was in college.
How did you decide to go from comedy to movies?
Well, really all I ever wanted to be was an actor. I never wanted to do comedy. I went to Carnegie Mellon and I studied acting. And at 19 years old, I came back to Los Angeles and saw that I couldn't get any acting roles to save my life. There weren't that many roles for 19-year-olds anyway, and Richard Dreyfuss was getting all of them. So there were, you know, some people in my life who convinced me that if I did stand-up, I could get all the work in the world and that would get me acting. And it really didn't work that way. It just got me more stand-up. So when in 1974, late 74, NBC decided that they wanted to, a little bit before then, I had written an article for Esquire called Albert Brooks' Famous School for Comedians. And there was a public television show on at that time called The Great American Dream Machine that would do various film segments. And I turned that into, I guess, what would be the first infomercial. And again, people thought it was real. I pretended that this comedy school existed and told everybody that they could be funny, and I took them on a tour of the school. But it was my first short film, and it was very successful. And it showed me that I could sort of translate my comedy to film. Then when NBC wanted to start, they actually wanted to, you know, do a Tonight Show on Saturday night, I was offered that as my own show, and I didn't want to do that anymore. I wanted to get into film. So they said to me, well, we would like you associated with this. At this time, there were no primetime players. Nobody was even on board. So in turn for coming on first and doing publicity and allowing them to use my name, I made an agreement to make 6 short movies for the first year of Saturday Night. And that was the greatest course you could imagine. Penelope Spheris, who now, you know, is a well-known director, she produced these shorts. And I, in a space of 8 months, I was able to write and direct and edit. And, you know, it was like juggling plates. I would be writing the third one, editing the second one, casting the fourth one. You know, I was just really able to learn a tremendous amount. And from then on, I never really, you know, got out of it. I made my first feature real life, and in that same year, I got my first acting job, which was Taxi Driver.
Yes, and your role in what a great film to get started in. Well, did you realize how lucky you were when you got that role?
Not until the president was shot. No. Then I thought, oh, my God, this is historic. No, I mean, I realized that Marty Scorsese was a great guy to have a chance to. Yes, I was able to figure that out, but who would ever know that that would turn out to be, you know, what a legendary movie.
Well, in Taxi Driver, you play a campaign worker on the presidential campaign who works with Sybil Shepherd.
Yes, and you know, there's a funny story with that.
Oh, because, tell it.
Well, Paul Schrader, that part wasn't written, so Marty Scorsese hired me and said, you know, maybe you could figure out that part and, you know, we could figure out the lines and everything. And so we worked on it, and what you see on the movie was sort of like developed in a hotel room. I just sort of worked on things, and he would tape it, and that's what would appear in the script. And when it was all over, Paul Schrader, the writer, said, you know, I want to thank you. that was the only character I really didn't know. And I said, really? I said, you knew Travis Bickle and Harvey Keitel and all of the pimps and hookers, but a simple guy who works in an office you couldn't figure out, huh? So it was really a great experience.
There's a scene where Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle, the taxi driver, is hanging around the campaign headquarters, you know, just eyeing Sybil Shepherd, who he really wants to pick up. And he comes in and tries to talk with her. And your character chases him out.
Yeah.
Did you come up with a way to do that and the lines to use and stuff?
Well, De Niro did something interesting because in those days he was, you know, very method, way before the restaurants, you know. He wouldn't ever even talk to me. So that moment of uncomfortableness was extra real. And, of course, I thought it was just, you know, about method acting. Then at the cast party, he wouldn't talk to me either. So, you know, he just didn't want to talk to me. But seriously, he wouldn't let me know him. I was trying to make conversation and say, so, you having, you know, fun doing this? And he would just walk away. So at that moment where I had to come up and figure out how to throw him out, It was extra tense because I didn't know who the hell I was dealing with.
Well, tell us how you and your character, as this very kind of like middle class campaign worker, who isn't a very physical person, deals with De Niro, who's this really threatening marginal figure, shadowy figure walking in.
Well, he uses the police. He keeps saying, there's police across the street. I'm going to call the police. I don't think he could do this alone. So that's really the only way he would do it. This guy I played is not going to get in a fist fight with the guy that Robert De Niro played. I mean, immediately De Niro goes into this karate position. And, you know, he's playing the world's most frightening man anyway. So all my guy is doing is, there's police across the street. I'm calling police, you know, getting police in there a lot.
My guest is Albert Brooks. His new movie is called Mother. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Albert Brooks. Now, after your role in Taxi Driver, which direction did you want to head in? The role of playing actors in, of being an actor in other people's movies, playing characters who weren't necessarily like you at all, or going in the direction of making your own movies and writing characters that were very, very close to your personality and directing it yourself?
I think if offers started to come in six a week, I probably would have just pursued acting only. I mean, I love to do that, but they didn't. So it forced me into writing. And once you're going to write, then you have to, you know, do the whole deal, because you can't, writing is the blueprint. And if you're going to, if I thought there was a director I could hand my stuff to and go home and go to sleep, I would. You know, part of me is a lazy guy, but I think that you need to, if you don't do it yourself, especially in comedy, you'll never get it right. The nuances will be wrong, the casting will be bad. And so once I decided that I could sit down and write these movie scripts, the rest was just something that, you know, I had to do.
There's a line that you're really quite famous for from Broadcast News, in which your character says, "Wouldn't this be a wonderful world if insecurity and desperation made us more attractive?" Did you write that line?
No, Jim Brooks wrote that line.
It seems like you should have written it.
Well.
Well.
I'm not taking credit for it because he might be listening.
Right. Did that ring true to you?
You know, not really. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I don't know. I don't feel that that's me necessarily.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
I play these characters. I'll tell you something. I once did a bit on television that I only did once, and it was on a Tonight Show, and actually Johnny was sick, and Joey Bishop hosted, and the fact that Joey Bishop did meant it was never repeated. And all I did was, it was about 5 years into my career, and I came out, and I sat down in a chair, and I talked to the audience for 3 minutes without getting a laugh about life and the philosophy of life, and I said, basically, I'm 5 years into my career, and I have no more material left. And I said, don't think I couldn't fool you, because I could. I mean, what do you think? I couldn't get a laugh? I could take down my pants and get a laugh, but that's not who I am. What, you don't think I could? And I wound up taking down my pants. I took off my shirt. I put eggs all over my head. I kept saying, you know, but that's not, I'm not going to really do that. And when I was finished, I sat there with no clothes and 16 pounds of food dripping from my face, and I looked right in the camera, and I said, but this isn't the real me. And then I took an 8x10 out of my shorts, and I said, this is the real me. So I have a half-brother, and somebody called him up. His name is Charles Einstein. He was a very famous sports writer. And somebody called him up after this and said, is your half-brother insane? They said, is he insane? And my half-brother said, no. And you know why? Because he went to the market and bought all that stuff. And, you know, that's really...
Right.
Right. I know all these things aren't... This is what I do. It's what I prepare to do. So I don't think that I'm literally those people.
There must be a reason, though, why you gravitate toward playing or writing characters who are somehow motivated by their neurosis.
Well, because I think that, you know, I never believed John Wayne. I just think that movies are so fake. And I just, listen, if an alien landed on Earth and went to our cinema, boy, wouldn't they be confused? They would think we're all police. And I you don't need me to do that. There's enough people to do that. So I just sort of, you know, am anti that. And anti that are people who are exposed, who are vulnerable, and maybe a bit screwed up, or whatever it is you want to call it. I just think it makes for more interesting, certainly more real, and certainly funnier characters.
In several of your movies, your characters have been divorced, or the relationship gets really rocky. Do you ever wish that you were married with children? Is that something you've wanted and haven't been able to get? Or is that something you never quite saw for yourself anyways?
Well, I have somebody in my life right now.
Good.
And if things go the way I hope it will go, that all finally might happen. So, you know, talk to me in a year. I just, you know, here's the thing. I never wanted to do this wrong. I know one thing about myself. I would be a bad divorced person. I would really, if I had to drive and visit my child and leave, I would have a heart attack. I just know that I couldn't do that. So I was willing to let that not happen then happen wrong. And by the way, I'm not saying that if it did happen, I wouldn't fail at it, but at least you know when you're going into something, mm-hmm. you know that deep down place where you think you've got a chance or you don't. So I've waited very patiently. You know, I'm the third little pig. I've always felt that that's who I was, and I've been building this brick house, and I'm telling you right now, I am not letting the other two pigs in. I'm sorry. I just figured if the other two pigs were listening, they're going to be pissed.
Oh, one real last question now. Has your mother seen the new movie?
Yes, she has. She's seen it a few times now. My mother does the funniest thing about my movies. Well, first of all, I know what you're going to ask. What did she think?
Oh, did she get the jokes?
Oh, yeah. The first thing she said is, you know, honey, I think one or two things are from us. I said, one or two things? It's an hour and 40 minutes. And my mother praised me. She liked this the best. And she praises me by using my other movies. She says, you know, she says, I think this is going to be the most popular because in this one you don't have to die or drop out. Or I said, I know, I get it. I understand what you're saying. But you know something? She really did like this. I can tell. I know my mother, and I think that she loved it.
Albert Brooks directed, co-wrote, and stars in the new movie Mother. Coming up, a new Miles Davis, Gil Evans box set. This is Fresh Air. Between 1957 and 1962, trumpeter Miles Davis made four records featuring orchestra arrangements by Gil Evans: Miles Ahead, Porgy and Bess, Sketches of Spain, and Quiet Nights. Miles Davis and Gil Evans also recorded a few other orchestra pieces together later in the 60s. All of this music is now collected in a lavish box set. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
That's Gil Evans' 1963 score for a stage play called The Time of the Barracudas. It's from the 6-CD box, the complete Columbia studio recordings of Miles Davis and Gil Evans. Like other big sets of historical jazz recordings, it's ostentatious. The CD sleeves are bound together into a classy little book whose spine looks like a gold money clip. That says it all. Such boxes are designed to confirm your affluence as well as taste. By some secret industry law, big box sets must include extensive but repetitive annotation and lots of alternate takes, incomplete performances, and studio small talk. There's about one CD too much of that stuff here. Anyone who has the albums Sketches of Spain, Porgy and Bess, and Miles Ahead has the meat of this collection, but much of the behind-the-scenes material is fascinating if you already know those records. For instance, you can hear Miles trying out I Loves You Porgy on open horn before putting in the Harmon mute he used on the LP version. These recordings have been issued and reissued several times, but never in the same form twice. For example, the original stereo and mono LPs of Miles Ahead contain some different material. The 1987 CD version, a notorious mess, used still other takes. The 1993 CD is almost the same as the old mono LP. Almost. As the box set makes clear, one reason for the confusion is that Davis left holes in some performances. Holes he'd fill in later at an overdubbing session. He did that so as not to wear out his chops, which were never so strong. He was an expert at recovering from mistakes. On another take of I Love You Porgy, He plays one long note way out of tune, holds it out of sheer defiance, and then a little later returns to the long note motif to resolve the tension and maybe poke some fun at himself. Gil Evans was Miles' equal and foil as orchestrator. Evans had a technical command of harmony and orchestral timbre surpassed only by Duke Ellington, whom he never tried to imitate. Instead, he wrote beautiful background pastels perfectly scaled to Davis's sound, and then coaxed the musicians into playing them as softly as possible. But Evans was also good at nudging Davis the soloist in odd new directions, especially on Sketches of Spain. This is Gil Evans' Soleil. The best of these recordings are classics, but not undisputed ones. They've been attacked with the specious argument that Gil Evans' arrangements sound like TV music. That's like putting down Shakespeare for writing all those clichés. It is true that Gil Evans' arranging style had a lot of influence, not least on those jazz musicians who wound up playing and writing in Hollywood. But then, some of us like jazz on TV. It's also true most people know Evans and his music only through his association with Miles Davis. Miles had more than a share of collaborators who got less credit than they earned. The flip side of the deal was, nobody was better at getting a composer's music out there, even if Miles' name was always so much bigger on the cover. Folks remember these records because of Miles Davis, but at least half the reason they're worth remembering is Gil Evans.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Miles Davis and Gil Evans' The Complete Columbia Studio Recordings. Today we reluctantly say goodbye to our intern Annie Bacon. She's corroborating the theory that working on Fresh Air makes you yearn for faraway places. Annie is off to Costa Rica and Nicaragua as part of her college program in Central American Studies. We wish her good luck. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.